who is the former center director here at Kennedy Space Center, now associate administrator, first time as associate administrator on our show. How's it feel?
It feels about the same as it did all the time, Blair. It just wouldn't be a launch if I wasn't able to go on air with NASA.
I really, really appreciate that. But actually, I'm super excited about what's going on today. We've had a lot of news lately about asteroids. NASA spent a lot of time lately covering this with OSIRIS-REx returning, obviously last year with the DART and Lucy, and now we're about to go to Psyche from a human spaceflight background, your astronaut background. How does it feel to see all these great science missions unfolding for NASA?
Oh, it's awesome, Blair. You know, why do we explore, right? The big question is there life out there beyond us? And without doing this, we'll never know. Okay, we have to explore. And the missions that we've done to these asteroids, that we could redirect an asteroid. I mean, that was phenomenal,
right?
But OSIRIS-REx, when it captured the material, it got way more than I thought. I mean, it like overflowed. They weren't sure they could shut the canister on it. And now, today, we find out they open up the big reveal, you know, at the Johnson Space Center. The administrator was there. We got carbon and water, the building blocks of life on an asteroid, and yes, that is absolutely amazing.
Right, and it's kind of exciting, too, because if you think about it, when we send astronauts back to the moon, they're going to find water ice as astronauts for the first time, and that's going to be also very exciting.
Absolutely, that's why we're going to the South Pole, Shackleton Crater, because there is water ice there. We think there's tons of it, and what is water and ice? It's hydrogen and oxygen. It's fuel and air to breathe. Because we want to make it, when we go back to the moon, we want it to be sustainable, you know, and we can't carry all the supplies with us. So we're going to do in-situ resource utilization, and this is going to be huge.
Yeah, and we're very excited. And of course, Psyche is really interesting, too, because this asteroid, unlike OSIRIS or Bennu for OSIRIS-REx, is this metal.
That's right, heavy metal. You know, who doesn't like heavy metal? Yeah, rock, you know?
I was so tempted right there.
I know.
If rights were involved.
The truth is, you know, all the exploration we've done in the past when we've gone beyond planet Earth, it's been to rocks or, you know, ice, right? This time, heavy metal. So learning more about how it formed, all of this helps us learn more about our own home planet.
Well, I tell you, I'm super excited. We can't wait to see the launch and get all this data back from Psyche. Bob, thanks so much for being on the show.
Blair, thanks so much for having me. It's always a pleasure.
We love it. Well, I tell you what, let's continue learning more about this incredible mission to the asteroid Psyche.
Many members of the Psyche team gathered at AstroTech for Media Day to share with folks exactly what Psyche's doing on this mission. I had a chance to sit down with Lindy Elkins-Tanton, the principal investigator for Psyche, to learn more about the science behind this incredible mission. Lindy, tell us, what are the scientific objectives for Psyche?
You know, one of the big questions that we have as humans is, why are we here on this wonderful planet Earth? Why did life arise on Earth? And the question of what makes a rocky planet habitable and able to support life is a very fundamental question. One of the parts of that recipe is that deep inside this rocky exterior of the Earth, there's a metal core. And that metal core creates our magnetic field, which one of its things is that it protects the atmosphere. And so metal cores, how do we learn more about them? We can't ever get to ours, or the one that's inside Mercury or Venus, or the Moon has one too, or Mars. But there's this one object out in the asteroid belt that seems like it's got a metal surface and is largely made of metal, and that is the asteroid Psyche. So we think that Psyche is part of the metal core of a very early formed tiny planet that didn't become part of our rocky planets, but instead got stranded in the asteroid belt. So really, we're going to outer space to investigate inner space.
How do you even find such a rare thing, a sort of that planet at its early stage, right?
The kind of the shrapnel, the leftover pieces of planet formation is the asteroid belt. That's where all the extra pieces got stranded. You know, you imagine you're making a cake and that's the Earth and you have all these ingredients and they all get completely heated and melted and then mixed and then separated into this cake. And you want to know what are the eggs and what's the flour that went into it. The place to look is the asteroid belt.
And so now that you've identified Psyche as this key foundational asteroid to look at, how do you look at it? What are you looking for?
Mm-hmm. We've done our best from Earth and learned everything that we can. Back when Psyche was discovered in 1852, no one knew what it was made of. And it's just the last couple decades that we could, from Earth, begin to put together the data that shows that it's made of metal. But to learn more, we've got to go there with this spacecraft. And the question is, what do you carry? What science instruments do you carry to go investigate an unknown object, a kind of object that humans have never looked at before? So we picked a really beautiful suite of instruments. Of course, we're bringing imagers because we've got to know what it looks like. We always want to know, what does it look like? And so we'll be sending back pictures just constantly. And then we brought magnetometers to measure whether or not it has a record of its magnetic field from the past. And then we brought this spectacular instrument called a gamma ray and neutron spectrometer, which can measure the composition, the kinds of atoms in the surface of Psyche from orbit.
Wow.
It's an amazing technology. And then finally, we'll use our radio communications to actually measure the gravity field of Psyche and make a map of the densities of the object. So that's what we're going to do when we're there.
So with these instruments and all the data you're gathering, you'll be able to tell in terms of metal, like which metals are actually there.
Right. We're pretty sure we know what it is based on the meteorites that fall to the Earth's surface.
Yeah.
And so the metals that appear in meteorites have a very narrow range of what their composition is. And they're all between approximately 90 and 100% iron. And then there's a lot of nickel. And then there are trace elements besides that. And so I would say that in terms of knowing ahead of time, that's the thing we're most certain of. Like, the metal is going to be iron and nickel. And then beyond that, it's all discovery.
I'm intrigued by this magnetometer because I'm a big fan of our magnetosphere, right? I love that, right? And I love auroras. I love the things that we get as
right?
a result.
Yeah, yeah.
But to think that there might actually be some remaining
yes.
magnetic field, and what we can learn about our magnetic field and how it developed, how will that science be used?
Yeah, it's very important to distinguish between an active magnetic dynamo and simply a rock that records a magnetic field. And so on the Earth, we have an active magnetic dynamo created by the fact that our outer metal core is still liquid and it's boiling effectively, it's convecting, and that makes a magnetic field. But if you were to have a slab of magma on the surface of the Earth and then allow it to cool while that magnetic dynamo is going on, it will record and freeze a record of that magnetic field. So that piece of frozen lava itself doesn't create a magnetic field, but it's a historic record of the field it was in. And that's what we're hoping to find at Psyche, that sort of frozen historic record of what Psyche's past was. And we sure hope it has a strong magnetic field, and that would tell us about the formation of these early planets.
Psyche, can you give us an overall key objectives for missions like Psyche and from a headquarters level and what they mean for planetary science in the agency?
Sure. So the Planetary Science Division is my favorite division. I hate to say it to any other ones out there. But we have a variety of science divisions within our directorate, Science Mission Directorate. Within our Science Division that studies the Earth, which makes sense. Heliophysics Division, which studies the Sun and the interactions between the Sun and the Earth. Astrophysics Division, where we have things like James Webb Space Telescope and Hubble Space Telescope. And Planetary. The really nice thing about Planetary is we go to the Moon. We study the Moon. We go to Mars a lot. We go to outer planets. We go to asteroids. We have so many different types of missions. We have orbiters. We have impactors. We have rovers. We have helicopters. And all of these things are driven by basically a decadal survey that NASA listens to that is done that says, look, this is the sort of science that we think is important to do in the coming years. And Planetary gets a survey like this that says that for your next 10 years, this is the sort of thing you should focus on. So we focus on Mars, like I mentioned. Focusing on asteroids is a very big thing because it says a lot about the origins of our solar system, right? Psyche is phenomenal because this is only the 16th asteroid ever discovered. And as you've probably heard Lindy Elkin Stanton say, it's believed to be the metal core of a planetesimal.
So us being able to study that in particular means so much for everything as far as the origins, perhaps, of the human species, how the Earth was formed, the ability for us to look at this as opposed to looking at Earth's core, which we can't do. It's too hard to look at. So if you find an exposed core, that's fantastic. So it all fits in very well with our portfolio and with the agency's goals of understanding where we came from, how the universe is made up, and us particularly, the planets in the solar system.
Bill, that was an extraordinary answer, and we are really short on time today, but we thank you for joining us on our show. Next, Blair had an opportunity to sit down with Henry Stone, who talked about the satellite, Psyche satellite propulsion system.
After hearing from the scientists at Media Day here at Astrotech, the reporters were able to go in and talk to the engineers in the clean room about the spacecraft. One of those engineers is with us now, Henry Stone, the project manager for Psyche. Henry, I want to talk about some key features on the spacecraft for Psyche. Tell us about these large, massive solar panels you guys are using.
Yeah, absolutely. It's one of the most dominant features of the spacecraft whenever you see a picture of it or a model of it. These are very large arrays that we have one on either side of the spacecraft made up of five panels, so in a cross pattern. They're large. They're 800 square feet of solar panel surface area, and that's used to generate all of the electrical power that the spacecraft needs to operate all of its instruments, the science instruments, the engineering instruments, and to power the propulsion system. This is a solar electric propulsion mission. It's not like the traditional chemical propulsion. Using a first-time technology in deep space, which is these Hall thrusters that will basically ionize a gas, xenon gas, that is the main propellant, and speed those ions up through an electromagnetic field to create the thrust that'll take the spacecraft, you know, 2.5 billion miles to get to this asteroid, way out in the asteroid belt.
Not just around the corner.
not just around the corner. Even as an engineer, it's kind of boggling when you start thinking about how large those numbers are and what they mean, right? That's 10,000 trips to the moon. 10,000 trips to the moon. Wow. And it'll be powered almost the entire time, unlike a chemical propulsion mission, with these ion engines, just putting out a little mist of ions.
That's what I wanted to ask you. I understand that we think of propulsion, you usually think of massive thrust.
Right.
And this is kind of the opposite. It's sort of like gentle nudge. How does that work well for the spacecraft?
Well, it's a very efficient form of propulsion. And it also allows you to drive or steer the vehicle continuously. If you do chemical propulsion, you kind of get periodically a big bang. Every couple of months you go and you fire, you make a correction as to where you go, and then you glide and coast for months and months and months, and then maybe you do another correction. Here we're actually steering, driving the vehicle essentially the whole time. And for this mission, that's a 5.5 year cruise that these engines will be running almost all that time. And the other thing is that given that amount of time, the amount of force that you need to apply when you're doing it all the time is very small, right? You can imagine, a roll of nickels or dimes in your hand. That's the amount of force that those engines put out when they're on. But it'll accelerate us up to, hundreds of thousands of miles per hour.
Has this type of propulsion been used on lots of other missions, or is this new technology?
There have been a few other missions. This technology is used by Maxar, who actually built a large portion of this particular spacecraft for us, in communication satellites around the Earth. But only a few missions have used an earlier version of just ion propulsion to go to deep space. This is the first time use of these particular Hall thrusters, as we refer to them, that are particularly good at accelerating these ions to very high speeds, that even though it's a few little ions, they're giving you a lot of propulsive force, a lot of thrust.
Now, I understand that in addition to this incredibly cool solar electric propulsion, you're also using some planetary assistance during the trip. And understand you're going to swing by Mars.
Yes, we will. In 2026, After we've gone around a ways, working our way out, we're going to do a Mars flyby, and basically like a slingshot. We've done this on many other planetary missions, and it's a very effective way to pick up a tremendous amount of speed in order to get, you know, out to the regions where we're headed, right? This asteroid, 16 Psyche, that we're going to study is kind of on the outer edge of the main asteroid belt, which is situated between Mars and Jupiter. So it's a long ways out.
Considering all the energy you guys have put into this mission to make it successful, once you've done those four orbits of Psyche, what's the potential of going even further? Or what happens next for Psyche if you keep going?
Well, you know, that would be the end of our prime mission that we've currently signed up for. And obviously, if the spacecraft continues to function and working properly, and we expect to have additional fuel at that time if everything goes correct, we could potentially do an extended mission. And I think that the leading plan or objective or goal at that point would be just to keep going down lower and lower and get even more close-ups of what is really going to be a very exciting and interesting body to take a look at.
Joining us now is Julie Lee from Maxar, the partner that actually built the spacecraft for Psyche, correct?
That is correct.
Awesome. Thanks for being on the show.
Thank you for having me.
I have to say, too, you have an incredible outfit. It's the most thematic wardrobe we've seen on the show.
Oh, thank you very much. I like to dress for the theme.
It works great. And I'm wondering, we love talking to partners on these missions because so many people are involved, but you guys worked in particularly with the solar electric propulsion system for Psyche, and I'm wondering, have you built a lot of these missions with a lot of solar electric propulsion spacecraft before?
Actually, yes. So this particular electric propulsion system, we've built dozens of and is currently flying on over 40 spacecrafts on orbit. So we know it's extremely reliable, has a lot of flight heritage, and we're simply elevating it for the first mission beyond the moon for Psyche.
So it's interesting you said beyond the moon, because it seems like I know that when you send a spacecraft up, it's on its own, there's not much you can do, but is there a different sense when you're sending something much, much further out into space?
Definitely. So deep space, there are a lot of unknowns. It's a very volatile environment. There's thermal fluxes, space dust, meteorites. We don't know what's out there. And it's harder to communicate with that spacecraft since we're so far away. And also, we just simply don't have a lot of data that speaks to how our hardware performs out in deep space, because there's not a lot of deep space missions.
Well, I imagine if this is successful, which we expect it to be, you'll get a lot of data for maybe future deep space missions for solar electric propulsion at Maxar.
Oh, definitely. This definitely opens up the gateway for numerous possibilities for missions far beyond our current solar system.
Anyone you want to talk about in particular?
Well, Maxar's next high-visibility NASA program is PPE, which is the Polar Power Propulsion Element for the Artemis Gateway program.
Yes,
and essentially we are a lunar tug for multiple modules. So in this case, propulsion will be the payload.
Nice.
So we will be tugging multiple modules and will essentially create an ISS around the moon.
I'm sorry, I just had to pause on that for a second. That in itself is very cool. And of course, we wish the best of success for Psyche, but also looking forward to this really cool Artemis mission for you guys.
Definitely. So we will be essentially evolving the Psyche's current electric propulsion system to have three times the power for PPE.
Awesome, awesome. Well, Julie, thanks so much for being on the show.
Thank you so much for having me. This was extremely fun.
Excellent, excellent. Now, we're going to go take a look at the pad where Franklin and Mick had a chance to look at the rocket up close yesterday as it was rolling out to pad 39A.
We're here with Mick Waltman just outside of Launch Complex 39A, outside of the SpaceX hangar with the rollout of the Falcon 9 Heavy. Mick, tell us a little bit about what's going on behind us.
Yeah, the Falcon Heavy is coming out of the hangar. It's on the transport erector. The team is working to move the vehicle out to the pad so that they can get it vertical for launch on Thursday.
Now, Mick, the LSP's use of the Falcon Heavy is a first for LSP. Tell us about it.
Yeah, it's our first Falcon Heavy with our commercial partner, SpaceX. It's this actually is designated FH-8. It's the Falcon Heavy 8th flight for SpaceX. But for us at Launch Services Program, the Psyche mission is our first use of the Falcon Heavy. And we are so excited to be partnering with SpaceX for this mission. The two side boosters have previously been flown on other missions, so we're excited about that. Center core is brand new, will be expended on this vehicle due to the performance needed for the Psyche mission. There will be no propellant left in an attempt to land the center core, so we will expend that and do that. So we're again excited for this Falcon Heavy. It is our first of three that we're working with SpaceX over the next year. Psyche today, and then next year in April, our GOES-U mission, and then of course Europa Clipper after that with our next Falcon Heavies.
Finally, before we go back to the studio, Mick, how long is this rollout process going to take?
Yeah, it's going to take the team about 4 hours to get from the hangar to Launch Complex 39A. Once they get there on what they call the dance floor, they'll get the vehicle mated up to the pad, and then they'll get ready to take the vehicle vertical later this evening.
Thanks, Mick. We'll see you later on in the show, but right now, we'll send it back to the studio.
Joining us now is Mira, who's working with sort of an additional experiment on the Psyche mission, DSOC, the Deep Space Optical Communication Experiment.
That's right.
Awesome. I always like to get that right if I can. Can you tell us, what is this experiment? Because we know it's very important for the mission.
Right. So basically, the objective of DSOC is to send higher data rates than what can currently be supported with the radio frequency comm systems that most deep space missions currently utilize.
Go ahead.
Right, so I was just going to say, so there are actually three parts to this. We have a flight instrument that is installed on the Psyche spacecraft, and then we actually have two ground instruments, and this is something that's unique about the DSOC project, because we don't have an existing ground infrastructure for optical communications. So we actually had to develop a ground terminal and for transmitting as well as for receiving, so there are those three components together.
And I imagine that's got to be pretty important for the mission, because without, or if you're going to develop an ultimate infrastructure for when you are regularly using optical communication, you want to know how to develop that and moving forward.
That's right. Yeah. And the thing about DSOC is it is very interactive. You need the ground transmitter to send up a signal, not just to send data up, but also to provide a pointing reference. It's like a beacon. And then the flight terminal uses that as its reference to then point back to the receiver station where our higher data rates come in.
Awesome. And then, of course, what's really interesting is you guys are not just in low Earth orbit or even around the moon. This is the first time you're really going into deep space with an optical communication experiment.
That's right. There have been previous optical communications demos that have gone up to the lunar distances, but this is the first time we're going to go beyond lunar distances all the way out to approximately Mars far range at distance.
That's awesome. And of course, going that far means you'll be prepared to implement this technology on future missions to Mars and all other missions that go into deep space.
That's right. We hope to. I mean, our overall goal is really just to gather information.
Sure.
We want to basically figure out, you know, how do we actually run an optical comm link as opposed to the traditional RF links that have been, you know, kind of well developed and established.
That's awesome. We love laser communication, optical communication. We've done several stories on it, so we're happy to see this mission take place, this experiment take place. Thanks so much, Mira, for being on the show.
Well, thank you very much for having me.
You're welcome. And awesome to say, SCAN, which is another part of NASA, which is responsible for seeing this great technology actually be implemented into our architecture at NASA. Let's take a look at SCAN.
We are SCAN. We are advancing today's space communication and navigation services and technologies to meet tomorrow's challenges. SCAN is committed to ensuring vital space communications through a network of complex ground stations and tracking data relay satellites. Together, these systems enable continuous communications and global coverage for space programs. Every space mission delivers terabytes of vital information for the process of scientific discovery. Our extensible and expandable Communication and Navigation Infrastructure provides a resilient space framework that can meet the growing requirements of our users. We develop, operate, manage, and engineer pioneering solutions. The most exciting part of this journey lies ahead, collaborating with commercial industry on major advancements in space communications. Our next generation of visionaries are creating a bright future, enabling Artemis lunar communications and a pathway to Mars. NASA Space Communications and Navigation. SCAN. Exploration enabled.
Joining us now is Jason Mitchell, who works with SCAN in NASA headquarters. Jason, thanks for being on the show.
Thank you.
Well, I tell you, we just talked to Mira about DSOC. We just saw this piece on SCAN. Tell us, how important is DSOC for the future of SCAN and for future NASA missions?
It's extremely important. We are struggling with being able to meet capacity in the future, as just like we do here on Earth. People need more and more data. Missions need more and more data. Right? More data means more discoveries. And so technology drives that capability. And that's what we're trying to do as SCAN, is making sure that we've got a capability. And later come on with DSOC as a demo. That's what's going to deliver that capacity for future science and exploration.
Just please tell me SCAN is not going to limit the number of log-ons I can have in my household. No, but seriously, it is important. We're on the precipice of this new technology and really seeing it mature. What are your thoughts on how this is going to eventually be integrated into all future or many future spacecraft?
So it will depend on the architecture that we choose to support the sort of the enterprise capability, right? When folks come to SCAN, their mission, they need to get their data back. We have to make a commitment to them to be able to receive that data. And so it will really depend on the architecture. Largely, it will be just like DSOC. A user will get a terminal, it'll plug onto their spacecraft, and then the back end part, whether they connect to a relay that's around the Earth, or they go direct to Earth, or maybe a relay around the Moon, or maybe a relay somewhere else, like a libration point or something, a Sun Earth Moon, or Sun Earth libration point, could help.
That's actually really interesting, because I always understood sort of the line of sight with the laser communication, but the idea of using other spacecraft to actually help you make those connections is pretty critical.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Well, I tell you, it's really also very interesting that we've sort of watched laser communication develop over the years, and so it's fascinating to see that it's now maturing, if you will, but it's not like a either-or. Either radio communications or optical communication. Talk a little bit about why it maybe could be both. You tell me.
Correct. So when a mission comes to us, they have a need. We work with them to deliver whatever it is that they need. So different missions will have different requirements, and to meet those requirements, it really is a both. It will be whatever is appropriate for the mission.
But I imagine in this day and age, with all the sort of the high-fidelity imagery that tends to come back, that pipeline has got to be very important.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. Particularly for Earth observation, we expect that to go very high as you think about the new LiDARs, new capabilities, high data rates from these Earth observation instruments to get more spectral responses. But also for the human side, as we send humans farther and farther into space, we want to make sure that they're connected so that we can get data not just from them about how to operate, but to them so they can still feel connected back to Earth.
Absolutely. Well, Jason, thanks so much for being on the show. We're very excited about SCAN, but we're going to go look to the pad right now and then get our final update on Psyche from Franklin and Mick Waltman from Launch Services Program.
We're here with Mick Waltman. Mick, can you give us an update on the status of the launch vehicle?
Yeah, Franklin, as we just saw out of the pad, the Falcon Heavy vehicle is vertical and standing there ready to launch tomorrow morning. Teams have checked everything out and completed all their operations, and we'll go on console early tomorrow morning and get ready for launch.
Now, there's been some concern about the weather. Can you give us some information on the factors that go into a go, no-go for launch as it pertains to weather?
Yeah, every launch vehicle has some range weather constraints, and with the front moving in, the weather's going to be a concern. The team will be looking at that. We're going to be looking at liftoff winds and some field electric strength measurements that are happening with the front, and the clouds are moving in. But the launch team will monitor those and take a look at them, and I'm sure there'll be a lot of discussion tomorrow morning on the console.
Mick, thanks for being on the show. You'll be on console for the launch. And everybody who's out there watching, make sure you tune in to NASA.gov and NASA TV for updates on the launch. And make sure you stay tuned to NASA Edge's social channels. You're watching NASA Edge, an inside and outside look at all things NASA.